And the time is 10 a.m. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Oregon Peace Works, presenting the second annual Gala Mardi Gras benefit Saturday, February 25th at 6 p.m. in the Grand Ballroom, downtown Salem, featuring music by Kate Sullivan and Company, Voodoo Mountain Zydeco, and Zydeco Dance Lessons by Deborah Seek, plus the political satire of Dr. Atomic's Medicine Show, with New Orleans-style food included, auction with unusual items, and a no-host bar. Tickets are available at 503-585-2767 or OregonPeaceWorks.net. Good morning. You are listening to People Rise Up on your non-commercial community radio station, KBOO, here in Portland, Oregon, USA, at 90.7 FM and online at kboo.fm. My name is Andrew Geller, and today we are going to be looking at a topic previously covered here on this and other shows on KBOO, and that's the issue of global oil production, and in specific, its peak, commonly referred to as peak oil. It's probably a phrase familiar to many of you, and if it isn't, it's going to be, not only through this show, but through your daily life in the next years and decades. My guest this morning is Kenneth DeFaze. He is a geologist, and he has been working in, well, he's been working in academia. He's also been researching quite widely related to the issue of global oil production for decades. He's written a couple of books. In 2001, Hubbert's Peak, and in 2005, Beyond Oil, The View from Hubbert's Peak. He is speaking in town this Friday at a sold-out event, and I welcome you to our airwaves. Good morning.
Well, good to be with you, and I'm getting on a plane this afternoon bound for Portland.
Excellent. Now, the issue of, and I'm just going to refer to this as peak oil because it's the simplest way instead of my longer-winded explanation at the front end. The issue of peak oil has gathered some steam in the past couple, 3 years in somewhat the general public, but it's likely that in the world of, oil workers in a broad sense, geologists to be included, this has probably been something that's been talked about since, you know, the 70s in terms of global peak. Your old colleague M. King Hubbert predicted the U.S. peak accurately 15 years before it happened. How does it feel to you to actually now have something that has been of interest in your field for a long time to actually kind of get into the broader culture?
Well, it doesn't feel good in the sense that it's going to cause us a lot of pain. So I feel like I've been the bearer of bad news. But I was trying to get the warning out for people to, you know, start scurrying for shelter.
Now, you are unique as far as I've been able to find in my reading for this show, in that you, just about 10 days ago, February 11th, on your website at Princeton, say, peak oil has come and gone, and the global peak in oil production happened just under 2 months ago, in fact, December 16, 2005. Now, let's have you actually explain initially why peak oil is not debatable.
Well, of course, it is debatable, but it's just by people who haven't figured it out yet. No, the method that I use, and I explain it on the website, is Hubbert's theory, saying that the ease of finding more oil depends on the fraction of oil that hasn't been found yet. And of course, when you found 100% of the oil, your discovery rate goes to zero. And so I start with that, and by taking the dates of discovery of oil fields, I can see how the discovery thing has gone, and that points pretty closely to 2,000 billion barrels, it's really 2013 billion barrels, of total oil, you know, when the last well runs dry. Then, and that's the discovery rate, and I come back to the production rate, and the math that Hubbert used, and I explain that in an easy way in Chapter 3 of Beyond Oil, Hubbert's math says that when half the oil is gone, you go through the peak of production. So I take half of 2013 billion barrels and say, well, when did we produce, you know, half of it? And that comes out to be in December. Now, I had predicted 2 years ago that it would happen on the American Thanksgiving Day, November 24, 2005. And it turns out I missed it by 3 weeks.
And I just actually want to offer a correction. It's trillion barrels, not billion.
Yeah, 2013 trillion barrels. Now, I was forever getting confused because there's the year 2013 and there's 2013 billion barrels, and I was always getting confused, so I had to write my computer program for 2.013 trillion barrels to keep from getting confused between the years and the amounts.
Now, and as I mentioned, as far as I've been able to find, you're the only person who in fact says, yes, we've hit the peak and we are now past it. And in fact, you close that article by saying, my career as a prophet is over. I'm now a historian. How is it you mean that?
Well, I mean that it's now past, and so we're looking back at it rather than looking forward at it. And I'm not the only one. Boone Pickens, who's a geologist, but also more famous as a corporate raider, has said that 2005 is the peak year. And Matthew Simmons, who's head of the largest merchant bank in the oil industry, Simmonsco International, his name's over the door, has said 2005 is the peak year. So I'm good company.
Okay, now, I looked through your math. It seems straightforward enough. At what point, I mean, you're confident, but as a scientist, you're more than well aware that you need some fairly significant corroboration for the mass of your potential audience to go, well, yeah, he was right, December 16, 2005. So how long do you think it'll take for people to be able to look back and go, wow, okay, yeah, 2005 was it?
Well, it might be as much as 20 years. which you're not allowed to sit around. Well, you're allowed, but you're going to be in deep trouble if you sit around and think about it, saying, well, no, I'm not sure yet, right. While the world comes crashing down.
It sounds like the climate change global warming debate.
Right, that's correct.
Okay, now, I found several articles here that I thought were fascinating that seemed to support your assertion that global oil peak happened in mid-December. Kuwait's biggest oil field has started to run out of oil, the Bergen field. This was admitted by the Kuwaiti oil company and published in the Kuwaiti Times. They are claiming that they actually, based on the need to re-inject, was it nitrogen they were injecting there?
Or seawater, I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, I'm not sure in that specific field, but one of the things related to peak in specific fields is some of these fields drop off very quickly after the peak is hit.
That's right, and with more modern technology, specifically at Ghawar, which is the Saudi supergiant field, biggest one in the world, both in total amount of oil and in current production, they re-drilled the Ghawar field with horizontal wells instead of the old traditional vertical wells, and in terms of reservoir engineering, it was the right thing to do. But when water enters those the upper part, the horizontal wells that are draining the oil, things are over pretty rapidly.
Yeah, and there's reports, you referenced Matthew Simmons, when he put his book Twilight in the Desert out a couple of years back, I guess the estimate was that they were pumping 30% seawater out of guar instead of oil, and I haven't seen absolute hard numbers, but I've seen reference to now over half of what is coming out of Ghawar is in fact seawater. If that's the case, that means that field has peaked, correct?
Well, or is it close to its peak?
Okay.
And but the trouble there is, it's not so much the peak as the abruptness of the downside. And you can still produce oil even when it's 90% water, but you have to put giant pumps in there and move a huge amount of water to get a little bit of oil. Now, oil is so valuable that it's usually worthwhile, but that's not going to solve the world's thirst to try to pull the last bit of oil out of Ghawar with high-speed pumps.
Now, I referenced the Kuwait field. There is a field down in Mexico called Cantarell, down on in the vicinity of the Yucatan Peninsula, and that oil field was created by the meteor or comet that hit the Yucatan Peninsula 65-some million years ago, and pretty fascinating what it did to the planet, and ultimately it became a tremendous oil field. Last year, Pemex, the state Mexican oil company, noted that, in fact, Cantarell seemed like it was going into depletion and that 2005 production would be lower than 2004. In fact, last week, let me see, what's the date on this? Oh, it doesn't have a date. I pulled this as a fairly recent news article earlier this week, so I'm guessing that this, in fact, is still February 06. Last week, somebody leaked a top-secret Pemex Cantarell depletion study, and apparently Pemex is a lot more concerned about a situation that is way more serious than they've ever predicted, and production may drop by over two-thirds in 3 years. So
Cantarell is one of the three biggest fields in the world in terms of its annual production, its current production rate, and having that one drop off is going to be a pain. But the trouble is, all these little pains add up globally. And we already saw it with the two hurricanes, that any small disruption in supply now can cause huge swings in price.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO in Portland. My guest this morning is Kenneth DeFaze. He is a geologist and author of a couple books connected to global oil production peak. Hubbard's Peak, and Beyond Oil, The View from Hubbard's Peak. And you can find him online at, well, actually, several places. I'll give folks the princeton.edu site, and if you search for DeFeyes, that's DeFeyes, you will get his page. The People Rise Up website also has links directly to it. Now, the issue of peak production is sort of a desperate position for the world to find itself in. Demand is increasing. Many countries want to ramp their oil consumption up in a significant way, and yet supply, it appears, will now never be able to achieve demand. The market as such has price and there's price impacts as a result of that. I see articles this week from Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez saying that he may cut off oil shipments to the U.S. China and Iran are nearing a tremendously big oil deal in Iran's Yadavaran oil field. As I mentioned before, Kuwait's running out of oil. The Mexican field is running out. So let's talk a little bit about price and availability. Is $2.25 gas for car drivers going to seem like a nice scenario a year from now or 6 months from now?
Well, one, I'm not an economist, and two, the word that I've been trying to sell is that besides a general price rise, there already is huge price volatility, because when supply is closely matched to demand for in the next few years, any little disruption, political trouble one place, labor trouble another place, a hurricane another place, any one of those things can cause the price to shoot up. And similarly, if we were to have unusually warm winters in both the northeastern United States and Western Europe for a couple of years in a row, and everybody else behaves themselves, the price could go way down. And, of course, when the price goes down, a whole lot of people think, see, there was no oil peak. The price just went down. No. It's very sensitive when supply is very closely matched to demand. So we're going to see a lot of price volatility. And my take on it is watching the price is a very poor way to understand what's going on in the oil fields.
And it could be said, I suppose, that we've begun to see that, although it hasn't necessarily been placed in the context of peak oil, because it's not widely discussed, actually, in this country anyway.
It's even clearer in the case of natural gas. Alan Greenspan began warning us more than a year ago that the North American natural gas market was maxed out, and the price volatility in natural gas has been huge, bigger swings than the price of oil. It jumps from $4 or $5 to $15 in a few weeks.
Yeah, I think we've all seen that reflected, or many of us have seen that reflected in methane bills that we receive monthly for heat and cooking,
right,
and et cetera.
Right.
And
when I lived in Corvallis, it was electric heat from Bonneville Power, and it was renewable. It was, you know, a little bit expensive, but boy, it felt good that it wasn't fossil fuel.
Yeah, and not like prices back in New Jersey where you are, I'm imagining.
Well, actually, New Jersey gets a few good deals because the tanker ships come into refineries along the New York and Philadelphia waterfronts, and as a result, we're right there where the oil is unloaded and refined. So sometimes our gasoline prices are about as low as they are anywhere in the United States.
So now, we referenced several other countries where there's reports of oil supply disruption for whatever reason it is. There's also yesterday news out of Quito, Ecuador, that The state oil firm Petroecuador Monday declared force majeure and suspended its crude exports after a protest in a province forced it to shut down a key pipeline. There's also unrest taking place in the delta in Nigeria, where I guess Shell Oil is a dominant force. I haven't seen any news in the past 24 hours about this, but I'm curious. There's, you know, there's the geological reality of production peaking, and that can't be altered as such. But in these situations where supply is being disrupted for, you know, non-geologic reasons, do you anticipate that the fact that the peak has now hit, there will be greater interest in quelling any human-caused supply disruptions wherever they occur?
Well, quelling it, the United States Army was one of the things you would consider, you know, a threat to put down one of these problems, but they have shown in Iraq that they cannot very well do that. So one of the bad lessons from Iraq is everybody now knows that, I won't say that the United States military is a paper tiger, but there are limits to what the United States can do. And before, you know, there was always the possibility, look, if there were a real global crisis, that the U.S. and Great Britain and not France, I don't know who, would take over the oil fields in the Middle East, you know, for to make the world safe for, you know, all of mankind and ExxonMobil. And we now know that's not likely, and unfortunately everybody else knows that that's not likely. It's too big a task.
Yeah, I mean, it would seem to be, especially since the sources are fairly widely distributed. I mean, there's the Middle East, obviously. There's Western African fields that many people say are going to be increasingly important in the next 5, 10, 15 years, and that people here in the United States should anticipate, unless they're able to stop the action, U.S. military forces occupying parts of Western Africa as we venture through this decade and into the teens. There is also an article out yesterday from Reuters out of London with a headline, "World has bigger oil worries than size of reserves." And they quote Sadat Husseini, a former top official at Saudi Arabia's state oil company, Saudi Aramco, quote, "Production capacity over the next few years is more important than reserves," end quote, which is what you're talking about here. What I'm curious is, does the issue of production capacity, you know, he's saying it's going to be more important in the short run. Is the issue, by how much do you think the issue of reserves and known reserves, could it be trumped by production capacity?
I think it is trumped by production capacity. My joke is I can't drive my pickup truck into the filling station and just fill her up with reserves. It's going to be production capacity. Secondly, reserves are very badly known. Everybody's complaining about this, Matthew Simmons more than anyone, saying that you don't know what the reserves are. And in the scandal with Shell Oil Company, what was it, 3 years ago, overstating reserves had happened in what we thought was the most conservative and carefully run of all oil companies. So the reserves are not something that I use in making my predictions. I focus on discoveries when you found these oil fields. And look, the average barrel of oil being produced today is from a field discovered 30 years ago. We're running on our past successes. And ExxonMobil has a chart out that shows that the last year when we found more oil than we burned was 1985.
And so that did that have something to do with the oil glut in the later 80s? Or did those wells...
No, it happened. that if you, instead of talking about the production peak, you talked about the discovery peak.
Okay.
Then that's happened way back. And the fact that we've run from 1985 till today in, you know, with deficit financing with regard to barrels of oil, we've been living on our past successes. And that, all these things could have been recognized, were recognized a long time ago. Mm-hmm. But politically, it's no fun to get up and promise you blood, sweat, and tears.
Right.
And it's no way to get elected today. So my take is that we don't hear much about it from our political leaders because there's no good news there.
Well, but George W. Bush just recently reminded people here in this country, or maybe informed people in this country, that we're addicted to oil. I mean, he's got a plan, right?
Well, no, he's right. He's finally caught on. Well, he may have known it all along.
20 years in the oil industry, and he's just figured this one out.
Well, he wasn't really 20 years. He had a short, unsuccessful career in the oil business. And since then, he's been doing other things. But he, to his credit, finally said publicly, we got a problem. Now, what they're talking about doing, I was just shocked. This last budget had an item in there. Well, we want to increase the amount of solar energy that we use for generating electricity. Because it's now 1% of the U.S. Electrical capacity. Now, by the year 2025, we want a research program to make that 2%.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the line I posted on my website says, by 2025, we're going to be back in the Stone Age.
Well, and that's exactly where I wanted to go.
Well, too many people took that literally. I don't think we'll be chasing buffaloes with stone spear points, but by 2025, it's going to put a huge dent in our lifestyles.
Well, in the last couple minutes we've got here, explain just a little bit more what you see as the United States in 2025 looking like in terms of daily life. Be as general as you like.
I'm glad to be a historian now. we're going to have to abandon some things, like those nice fruits and vegetables that are flown up from the southern hemisphere during our winter. I've been getting beautiful blackberries from Mexico in the grocery store here, and they're not as good as Oregon summer blackberries, but they're good. And my regret is that a lot of those things will go away, and we'll have to start using locally grown crops. We'll have to start using root cellars to store the kinds of things you can store in the winter. And we're going to have to learn to love rutabagas and parsnips and turnips, all of which I hate. And we have to start getting out from under long commutes. We're either going to have to, you know, move your work to where your house is or get a residence close to where you work. There are a lot of things that we're going to have to change because they're very fossil fuel intensive.
Okay. I suppose we should just leave that there instead of trying to dive deeper, as we are out of time. My guest today is Kenneth DeFaze. He is a geologist and has written widely about global peak oil, and in fact says that on December 16th of last year, the world passed its peak oil point. He is speaking in town at a sold-out event this Friday for part of the Illihi Oil and Water Series, and encourage folks to check out his information online, and the People Rise Up website at KBOO also has a whole bunch of information, and we'll have some more shortly on this topic. Thank you very much for being on the program this morning, Kenneth, and wish you well in your travels out here and your talk Friday.
Thank you very much.
All right, take care. And with that, I want to let you know that if you have questions or comments on anything you heard today or any other day on this program, you can send email to me at kboo@riseup.net. You can send regular paper mail to me here down at KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Thank you very much for listening to the program. We'll be back next week, possibly with the next installation of It Is Happening Here. I need to figure out my schedule a little bit. 2 weeks from today, this program and many others will be preempted for International Women's Day, so do stay tuned for 24 hours of programming of, by, about, and for women. And then membership drive starts March 22nd, so start saving your money and figure out a way to support KBOO at that time. Coming up next, we got Making Contact.